Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Hi, it's Benjamin Hammer at the Young National Council of Young Israel. We are happy to welcome Rebbe. Rebbe Willig is with us for conference call number 18. We thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you. Kaminyan Chai. We should be zocher to talk about pleasant questions. Some of the questions today are not so pleasant. But if the questions are asked, I feel a responsibility to try to answer. We'll do what we can. Question number one. Recently, a male congregant who is married with children confided in me that he is addicted to internet pornography for many years. He's in a 12-step program these past 3 months and is hopefully on his way to recovery his term. A few questions. Is this really an addiction or a very difficult taiva? B. What is the Torah Shkaf in these situations if it is an addiction? Is he therefore an onus and not responsible for his actions? C. As Yirei Shemayim, we believe that Hashem does not give us any son that we cannot handle. I've been told by him that he will always be an addict and the 12 steps teaches him how to contain his addiction. Is that true? D. What is the Torah response to dealing with these difficult challenges? The 12-step program seems to have its roots in the form of spiritual healing. Is that acceptable according to Allah? All good questions. Let's analyze the first one, which is the most important. Is it an addiction or a very difficult taiva? Now, technically speaking, speak to the psychologists, they're unable, based on the limited data, to give a proper answer to that question based on their definitions. In other words, Alcoholics Anonymous has been around for a long time, and it's viewed as an addiction based on two criteria. Number one, in many cases, it takes over your life and ruins it. As we well know, alcoholics can ruin their lives. And number two, the understanding is that, as the questioner mentioned, it's with you for life, and you can't give a finger. You take one drink and you're toast. It's over. You have to stay away from alcohol completely, as you all know, based on AA. So the question is internet the same idea, internet pornography? There's not enough data. It's not that I'm here around enough years. The first criterion, I believe, is certainly true. There are people who are unfortunately overtaken by this Yetzer Hara, and it ruins their lives. Instead of going to work, instead of doing what they're supposed to do, going to school, they spend the whole day looking into internet pornography. So from that perspective, we can determine an addiction. And therefore, number two is probably also true, that you have to stay away even from a little bit, because a little bit will take you into a lot, similar to alcoholism. So if those two criteria are the ones that we're going to use, probably it should be considered an addiction. But you know, or a very difficult taiva. A very difficult taiva, you know, the two are not that different from each other. A very difficult taiva, which is non-addictive, means that it's used based on these earlier criteria. It doesn't ruin your life. Your life can go on as normal. You just have this particular nisayon. And giving it a little bit will not necessarily take you to the lowest level. So it's arguable that such taivas exist, but they're hard to come by. The taiva for znus, for gezel, all these things, people have it in their system. It's likely to be for a lifetime, and it's likely to be, if you give it a little bit, you may go all the way. So I'm not sure, from a halacha l'maaseh perspective, question A, is it addiction or a real difficult taiva, it makes that much of a difference from our perspective. In any event, I don't think it makes that much of a difference. Once again, we tell the person, yes, C is probably true. He'll always be an addict if he has this netiyah for this particular yetzer hara. Very hard to uproot it completely. And yes, he has to be careful for the rest of his life not to get involved whatsoever. And yes, he can handle it. And therefore, B, he is not an onus. He's bechira chavshus, and he's responsible for his actions. Now, we know that different people have different yetzer haras. The Gemara tells us so, that certain people have more of yetzer hara for chas v'shalom, for murder, and for gili arayis, and for gezel. There's all different types of bad things. You have to control yourself. Obviously, a person who has a bigger yetzer hara for something, so Kadosh Baruch Hu knows that and may judge him from the divine perspective less harshly. That's possible. We don't know for sure. But in Bezen Shalmata, the guy can't walk in and say, I killed, I stole, I was gili arayis because I have a taiva for it. That's no defense. It's a mitigating factor in Dinei Shemayim. But in Dinei Adam, it's not a defense at all. It doesn't rise to a level of insanity. There are people who say that, you know, he has a netiyah towards a murderer. And there are people who are giving this defense in various courts of law. But that's not true. The Gemara on Shabbos at the end says that the person is born in Mazel Madim can be either a Moel, a Sheikhet, or a Rotzeach. What it means to say is a certain Natiya. It's a little like he likes to deal in blood, but you have to channel it properly. The person has no right to have this Yetzirah of internet pornography come and being used in a terrible way. A person is required to get married. This fellow is married. He has children. So if he has a Yetzirah for women, he thank God he has a wife. And he should conduct himself properly towards his wife, not improperly, chas v'shalom. And if he does tshuva, this will prevent him from getting involved in inappropriate activities. 12-step programs are very good. It's a wonderful thing. If it works, it works. I know Rabbi Dr. Twersky is a big fan, and I certainly am a fan as well. As long as it works, I'm happy to invite people to do it. Unfortunately, this question that the rabbi received, I received the same question. You know, people are addicted to internet pornography for many, many years, and it can chas v'shalom destroy the marriage. I've been involved in quite a number of cases of this type. And it's not that the Yetzer Hara got stronger as such, it's that the availability is totally different. Pornography existed when I was growing up as a teenager. If you wanted to see it, you had to go into a store and buy a dirty magazine and hide it in a bag. It was difficult. People wouldn't walk in there. But today, anyone has an internet, it's right in front of you. Just press a button. Even if you don't press a button, it pops up at you. And people I know, Choshev Rabbonim, and Fine from Balabatim, have gotten stuck in this. And a few times the wife came to me that this, what kind of crazy man is this? You know, she wants to get divorced. I had to try to explain to her that the idea of this kind of a Yetzer that a man has to just follow his eyes, a woman doesn't have it, and it's not in her makeup. It's just a different kind of Yetzer Hara. She can't understand it. She can't judge him completely. But at the same time, he has to reform his behavior and behave more properly. Otherwise, it becomes a very, very serious problem. It's a challenge of our generation. Question two. Is paying a children's yeshiva tuition considered ma'aser money? What about stepchildren? On a simple level, we do not consider it to be ma'aser money. Not for a father and not even for a stepfather. It's not so much the technical obligation of limadatam osmas b'neichem which prevents it from being considered ma'aser money. If that would be the case, so your daughter's tuition could count for ma'aser money. It's a fortune of money that will take up all your ma'aser. The answer, I believe, is that in today's world, every parent has an obligation to train his children, sons and daughters, properly, give them a Torah education, because without a Torah education, there'll be an internet pornography, as we said. But there's no way to stop the individual from becoming part of the society at large. You can't homeschool your kids. So you have to send boys and girls to school. That's an obligation of every parent. Whatever's obligatory does not count towards ma'aser. In my opinion, a stepfather, when he marries his wife who has a child from a previous marriage, is, in our society, as a general rule, also accepting a measure of responsibility to see to it that his wife's child is not going to be in the streets, and therefore he has an obligation of tuition. That someone says there's another father, the natural father, if he happens to be alive, and if he's paying tuition, maybe different, but often he's either not alive or not paying tuition. So then he, the stepfather, in effect, has assumed this responsibility, whether spoken or unspoken, when he married his wife. And therefore, the fact that there's no vildimadatam is irrelevant from my perspective, and therefore, there's a problem. I do believe, however, that in some cases, part of tuition can be considered ma'aser money. As I said before, whatever's obligatory, davar shebechovah, as the poskim call it, cannot be utilized, ma'aser money cannot be utilized for that. Sometimes in situations of tuition, a family is really very dedicated to tuition, as they should be, and they're paying tuition to an extent greater than they would be absolutely obligated to do if they, for example, asked for tuition assistance, scholarships, etc. They would be given a break. So let's say, for example, tuition is $15,000, and if they ask for a tuition break, given their situation, they'd have to pay $10,000. But they say, you know what? We want to pay the full $15,000. In my opinion, the $5,000 could be taken from MISA money because the school would have given it for $10,000. They're paying $15,000. So I believe that's not obligatory in the full sense. And that's why I think that that money could be counting as MISA. But the core money that they would be have no choice but to pay should not count as MISA. Remember that MISA is only a minig. It's not a din d'oraisa, probably not even din d'rabbana. It's a very important minig. And also remember that MISA is only for a person who has disposable income. A person who has zero disposable income is not required to pay MISA. If you have money, if you make $100,000, you need every penny just to get by, you're putter for MISA. If you get a raise, and now you're making $120,000, and you can live on $100, you're required to give not just $2,000, you're required to give $12,000 of MISA because you're able to get by with a greater with less money than you're actually making. Okay, number three. As a follow-up to last week's question on stainless steel dishwashers, can they be kasha for Pesach? The answer is stainless steel, we do kasha for Pesach, and the dishwasher is not an exception. However, we have a general rule, we do not kasha plastic for Pesach because we're not exactly sure how it's made. Maybe it is a mashu. And if you accept that chumrah, and these days most racks are made from plastic, you would have to have different rack for Pesach. Question, is it worth it? Remember, Pesach is 5 days out of the 8 are Shabbos and Yontif in some years, at least 4. And so you're talking about 3 days. I'm not sure if it's worth it. When we bought a dishwasher, we bought a stainless steel. For having Pesach in mind, at the end we never did it. And we go back to Mitzrayim, a little zechut to Mitzrayim, the hard work of washing dishes for those few days. Number 4. This is the hardest of all the questions. In light of the difficult news we have heard regarding mikveh, conversions, and personal security, should existing protocols for conversion be changed, such as additional oversight or even women having more involvement with women's conversions? This is such a hard question to address, and I apologize if I can't address it perfectly. It's too difficult, but since the question is asked, I feel I have a responsibility to answer. Number one, we should always be sensitive to the sensitivities of gerim, men, and certainly women. I've become much more involved in gerim in the last number of years since the what they call the GPS, gerim protocols and standards system, was brought into operation. I was sort of compelled almost to participate in what they call the Manhattan Bezdin. We've done many, many garrison over the years. Whenever a woman undergoes a conversion, the mikveh lady is there. In addition, usually a friend or two of hers are there. It's done with perfect sneeze. Perfect sneeze means we see nothing. All we see is the back of her head when she's under the water. She turns around to show us her face. We know who it is. Her whole body is covered by an opaque, totally opaque sheet. And then after the questions are asked, she goes under the water. We still see nothing. Just as soon as we see the hair going under the water, we yell out kosher, slam the door. She knows there are no more men in the room. The mikveh lady tells her to say the bracha, ala tefillah, then go under the water a second time, as all married women do, after the bracha of ala tefillah. That second one is done in a more relaxed atmosphere, admittedly. However, the initial tefillah, which is of course the main tefillah, in the presence of the dayanim, is according to many, if not most rishonim, and many, if not most, close to all poskim these days, an absolute requirement. Yes, I'm aware of the fact that as of now, there have been those who have made a big deal out of having a woman see the woman be terrible. Men shouldn't be there at all. Of course, such an opinion exists within the halachic system. However, in my view, sensitivity to gerim requires that your gerim that you're doing for them is not going to be questioned. To perform a conversion, knowing full well that just for example, in Igros Moshe, it says that a woman who converted under such circumstances without men in the room has to undergo conversion again. And if she waits 20 years and has 5 children, they can also have to undergo conversion again. That's not Vahavta Mesager. That is short-sightedness. Yes, no men will be in the room. I read articles recently describing that a woman feels somehow in a state of her tznius being compromised, even if she's covered completely by a sheet. And I have to be honest, the same as I said before, that a woman should not judge men too harshly because of their yetzer, which she doesn't share, so too I as a man cannot say that there's no element of truth in what this lady is printing, that the maybe a woman feels a breach in her tznius, even if she's completely covered, if there are men in the room. And I sympathize with that sentiment. I think it's a wonderful, healthy sentiment. Tznius is such an important meter today, which unfortunately is being trampled upon everywhere we walk. Having said that, and to provide the proper service for this woman, that she should be considered a giyoris according to all rabbinic authorities and presently held positions, it is a necessary requirement. Some are pilpuling, instead of the sheet, she should put on a robe. My view is the robe is not as good from the halakha perspective, but I would not stand in the way. If a woman would say, I want dafka robe, it's fine. Some have a different system where the whole mikvah is covered with a sheet and only her head comes above the water and she goes underneath. It's also good. But the point is that these are small measures, and when we say that having women as the people who are in the mikvah only at the time when she goes under the water, I believe it's a disservice and a violation of Vahavtem Es HaGer. Because if the Geris is good, and Rabbi in 20 years will say, I hold like a measure, it's no good, what have you accomplished? You've done a disservice for this individual and for all of her future children. I think it's a very, very serious mistake. Of course, I'm not going to say that such a person is not Jewish for sure. You've created a limbo situation. So that's not a good idea. Not a good idea. I believe that additional oversight is always appropriate. You may have heard that the GPS has announced making an ombudsman, which is going to presumably a woman, who will be an address for people to complain. I think it's a wonderful idea. No one should be afraid of complaints. There's a bit of a controversy concerning they appointed a committee to supervise them. Frankly, I'm not against the committee in principle. I'm not happy with the precise composition of the committee, and it has nothing to do with gender. There are a few women of whom I approve on the committee, and a few men of whom I disapprove. I'm not going into any details right now. Nothing to do with the gender, but that's a question of how we oversee existing protocols such as the GPS. Women having more involvement with women's conversions, absolutely. Generally speaking, in our women converts, as I said before, there's always a woman in the mikveh, the mikveh lady, and often a friend as well. But even in the training of the teaching of the woman, almost always there's a woman whom we turn to teach prospective conversion candidates. Yes, many of them are studying in shiurim given by the rabbi who is a man. In some cases, it could even be some one-on-ones. I don't encourage it. Perhaps if there is a call to cut that out, even though you're sometimes disenfranchising a woman from the one-on-one with a very upstanding and righteous rabbi who's beyond reproach. But if there's a call for that, I think we're going to have to accept it. But I can't say a woman can't go to a shiur given by a rabbi. That's complete overreaction. I have to tell you, if one rabbi committed a terrible act, and we can't fault all the rabbanim in the country based on one person's terrible mistake. To my knowledge, no rabbi has come to defend him, even though I've seen in letters people are claiming that. It's just not true. People say, but it's not true. There are those, unfortunately, who are jumping on this as a metziah, an opportunity based on a previous agenda to attack all rabbis. You know, when there's a problem, the problem has to be eliminated. That the Bali Musa would say that sometimes there are mice in the house, and we want to get rid of the mice. So the Balabasta wants to get rid of the mice, and so does the cat. Balabasta just wants a house with no mice. The cat wants to devour the mice. So when people are criticizing, you have to be careful. Are they like the Balabasta or like the cat? Beware of additional agendas. I've seen not appropriate statements, very sharp statements against rabbis who are doing things properly, who spend countless hours for no money making a Kiddush Shem Shemayim, and they're called names by rabbis who should know better. I think it's beneath contempt. I think it's fueled by additional agendas, and people should try to be careful, but be miskabed b'klon chavero. Chazal very harsh about that, as if, you know, only I and my group, we are holy, and everyone else is unholy. Be so careful, so careful, so careful. Changing mikveh procedures is very, very dangerous. There are all kinds of new ideas about how to run a mikveh. Some of you may have seen some of the things which were sent out on the various sites, such as cross currents. It really is a little bit frightening. And when someone touches the raw nerve, as the commentator noted, the response is sometimes also beneath contempt. So these things are Dvarim Shebitzina, and we have to approach them, as Chazal say, appropriately, without the kind of modern approach which knows no bounds, in fact. Much more could be said, but we'll stop here and go to the next question. 5, with the proliferation of Torah on the internet, I find a number of congregants bringing their printouts to the shul and even making copies of their favorites for others to enjoy. The issue is that instead of davening, many are just reading the sheets. I can live with the readers, quote, not listen to my drasha if they are learning something, but some of the printouts are about politics and jokes. In addition, it makes the shul look messy and unattractive to the newcomers. Is this a topic to speak about from the Bima? Should I be telling the religious committee that this has no place in the basic Knesset? My shul is also filled with these kinds of handouts. I have never seen politics or jokes in them. I mean, it is true that Rabbi Wein, who's probably one of the most famous commentators, has usually two pieces. One is on the parasha, one is current events, we'll call it, which some might call politics. I found nothing offensive in what he has written. At the same time, whether it's his pieces or others are taken out from all kinds of places, from different Rosh Hashivas and different Rabbanim, I plead guilty. Somebody says Torah Web gives out, and I write myself for them once in a while. I think it's fundamentally a good thing. I believe that if indeed people are reading them during the rabbi's sermon, it's not appropriate. During davening, it's certainly not appropriate. And if people are bringing them from the outside and these manifestations exist, I would request from the people who are bringing them, do me a favor. If you want to bring something, please don't give it out until after davening is over. Take the high road. Don't try to attack. I appreciate you want to show people your favorites. It's a wonderful thing, our Bas HaTorah. But it's distractive. It's taking people away from davening and from Kriyas HaTorah. I'm asking you a favor. You bring it to shul, that's fine. Give it out, you know, by Ein Kalokeinu, when davening is almost over. That is a different story. But before that, and yes, you're right, someone said they left all over the place, it has to fall on the floor. That's not appropriate either, but, you know, that's a technical matter which should be taken care of appropriately. Number 6. This past week, I met with the shul's Vada Kovod review committee. There's always room for improvement, and I took their suggestion about me well, and overall the view was favorable. However, he did point out that my wife doesn't often come to shul, and when she does, it's the end of davening. We have three small children, and it's not easy for her to get out of the door, especially when we're hosting shul members for the Suda. Is this something I should even share with my wife? Answer, no, absolutely not. Should I respond at all to the committee? Yes, you have to respond to the committee. In the past, we've quoted Rav Moshe's Tshuva, Or HaChaim Chelek Dalet Siman Memtes, where he says the most important thing that a woman, a Jewish Torah woman, can do for Hashem and His Torah is having and raising children. There's no more important work, Rav Moshe writes, nothing more important than doing that. Any woman, Rebbetzin or not, who is busy taking care of her children, as a result does not come to shul, Tavo Aleha Brocha. When my children were young, my wife came to shul 4 days a year, 2 days Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Purim, to hear the Megillah. That was it. She didn't come. She was busy taking care of the children, and she stayed home. I believe that's the appropriate place for a woman to be when the children are young. Baruch Hashem, my children got older. Now my wife is in shul every single Shabbos, and not the end of davening, it's the beginning of davening. It's a different stage of life that she's in. I think it's not fair for Balabatim, even if they're on the Vada covered, you know, Eza Mechubad and Mechabad Esabrius. If they want to give covered, they should give covered to the Rebbetzin, and other women should follow the Rebbetzin's lead and stay home when they're taking care of their little children, and we'd all be better off. I don't think it's right that these people are complaining. If they insist, they think it's an integral part of the job description, the Rebbetzin has to be in shul and a little bit earlier on every single Shabbos. If they insist, look, we try not to fight with Baal HaBatim. Explain to them. They'll send an appropriate babysitter to the Rebbetzin's house. As soon as the appropriate babysitter comes and the Rebbetzin trusts the babysitter, she will leave the children in the care of the babysitter and come to shul. As early as the babysitter comes, that's as early as she leaves the house, obviously not before. And at those occasions, they shouldn't expect any invitations. If the Rebbetzin is leaving the house and she's unable to invite people on that particular Shabbos, so they just can't happen. And I think the Rebbetzin should be amenable to that if there's an appropriate babysitter for 2 hours while the Rebbetzin comes to shul. I think it's something which is very good. I mentioned before that my wife used to come to shul Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and probably we had to hire a babysitter from our own budget. So if the shul is willing to pay from their budget to hire an appropriate babysitter and that the Rebbetzin should come to shul, I think the Rebbetzin should say yes. But until that time, nothing should be said to her, and at that time, it should be presented as an opportunity, not a requirement. They may say to you it's a requirement. The rabbi tells his wife it's an opportunity to come to shul. Maybe it's a good idea. They'll provide babysitting. They'll pay for it. Then I think it's something which should be approached to with the rabbi, not before. Final question. Could a doctor risk going to help Ebola patients in Africa? Does it make a difference if the infected populations are non-Jews? There's a long discussion in Poskim. Is a person permitted, obligated to place himself into a situation which is known as Suffolk Sakona, in order to prevent a Vada Sakona? I think that's the most on-point citation. The Beis Yosef says, quoting from earlier sources, that perhaps there is such an obligation or at least permissibility. But in the Shulchan Aruch, he left it out. And there are those poskim who say he left it out for a reason, because he doesn't really want to poskim that way, not as a chiyuv, maybe not even as a rishus. So it's an unanswered question, even if we're assuming that all the patients would be Yisraelim, Kal v'chomer if they're not Yisraelim. So therefore, it's a very, very difficult question to answer. At the end of the day, there is certainly also a statistical component to this. How dangerous is it? Are there a significant number of physicians who are dying because of their involvement in trying to help a patient? I know that in the past there have been. Maybe there are better safeguards now. Clearly, there's a significant percentage dying. There's no obligation whatsoever to put yourself into that situation. If it's a very small percentage, so everyone puts himself into some sakana by just, you know, walking the streets, driving a car, going to certain places, whether they be in the chutzlar or in Eretz Yisrael, that's considered to be an acceptable risk, if you will. And I don't know the statistics on Ebola at the present time. I would not be able to venture a comment presently. Perhaps in the future, when more becomes clear, we'll be able to speak about this topic again. I want to thank you very much for listening. Wish you all the bracha v'atzlacha.
Rebbe, we thank you very much. We hope we could continue with the shilas as we go through.
If the shilas come, I'll try to give tshuvas. Okay, call to everyone.
Thank you very much.
Be well. All the way. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.